The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
There's a foundational book, teaching book in Zen called the Platform Sutra. And it's attributed to the sixth patriarch, the sixth teacher in the Zen lineage of Zen in China, who kind of, from him, the whole Zen tradition in China exploded into Chinese Zen. So he had this book called the Platform Sutra. And in there, there's a little teaching which is kind of profound, I think, or interesting, that is very simple. And in various ways, it says that wisdom and meditation are the same. Don't think that wisdom and meditation are different. They're one and the same. So there's kind of equality. So when you practice meditation, you're practicing wisdom. If you're practicing wisdom, you're practicing meditation. That's how it's translated into English. So once upon a time, I looked at the Chinese text to see what it actually says for itself. And it turns out it doesn't say that wisdom and meditation are the same. Because the word, the actual character there that translators translate as wisdom is the character for kindness. And so it says wisdom and kindness, kindness and meditation are the same. Don't think that kindness and meditation are different. They're one and the same. If you're really practicing meditation, there should be an element of kindness in it. And kindness is, I think of as a form of love that is doesn't involve personal desires, something wanting in ourselves, not about the transactional love where we love someone and want something in return. It's this kind of very generous spirit of the heart that loves without anything, needing anything back. Just a genuine, simple kindness. So I thought that was pretty cool to see that. Kindness and meditation are the same. So then I went to my one of my professors of Zen, who knows, you know, these texts very well, expert in Chinese and Japanese Buddhism and Zen Buddhism and the language, the characters and all that. And I said, look, what I found, that English translations say wisdom and meditation, but the Chinese actually says kindness and meditation. And he said, oh. The word for kindness, the character, and the character for wisdom are homonyms. They have the same pronunciation in Chinese. And so, and the characters kind of look the same, so he just said, oh, it's a scribal error. What do you think? Maybe there was an error, but which way did it go? You know, did it start with kindness, that was the original, or start with wisdom, what was it? So this idea of kindness maybe being foundational. Maybe kindness is the highest expression of wisdom. That kindness towards oneself, kindness to others, kindness to the world is to help create benefit, the best, highest benefit for everyone, how to care for ourselves and others. And one of the primary ways to benefit self and others, to care, is to help alleviate suffering. That all the different variations of what in Buddhism we call suffering, whether it's mild, irritation and stress, or whether it's some of the major big issues of suffering in our lives, sickness, old age and death, and tragedy of all kinds, that to live a life of kindness is not just simply to be sweet and nice around some, but rather to be, have a life where the coming out of your heart is a general, is a movement of love, of caring, of generosity to oneself and others, where the heart's desire is to consider the what's best for everyone involved, what's best for the world, to want to support and help. Very different than, you know, does, you know, operating from it's all about me. I want what I'm supposed to get, or my people, just all for my people, my family, whatever. But to actually have a heart that's open, full, and has space for generosity to come. And I kind of believe it's an article of faith, because I can't give you the scientific clinical proofs for this, that a heart which is deeply settled on itself, relaxed, not attached to things, we be open, present for the world and others, contented in a deep way, in some kind of deep, wise satisfaction that's just here, that the expression of that heart is takes the form of generosity, takes the form of kindness, as kindness being a form of generosity, takes the form of love. And that love is one of the primary treasures of human life, of the human heart. And maybe love takes many different shapes and forms depending on the person. So I kind of like the word, use the word kindness, if we're generous to the word. If we don't see kindness as being kind of like, you know, just kind of superficial, but see kindness maybe as a word like love, but more people can find themselves in. But the word love, you know, it's such a powerful word. And maybe, but kindness also is very simple and straightforward. So this idea that we can have a heart that is at peace, a mind which is at ease, that we can go into any circumstance, any situation, tragedy we find ourselves in, and be able to somehow keep the heart open, keep the heart calm, settled, so that the best qualities can come from it. So we're not afraid, we're not angry, we're not contracted, we're not so pulled in or contracted around our pain or suffering or what's painful, that those areas of kindness don't flow. And so in the Buddhist tradition, one of the primary aspects of this practice that we do is to not necessarily go directly to understand how to be kind, how to be loving, how to be at peace, but to really understand realistically and honestly how we're not. What gets in the way? What's actually going on? Your wisdom becomes very practical if you understand how you cover over your good heart, how you get caught up, how you get attached. And so Buddhism has a lot of teachings about how you get caught, how you get, you know, the heart gets covered over, how your freedom and awakening gets covered. The word hindrances literally means a covering in the ancient language, to cover over. And some people feel like maybe sometimes the Buddhism is kind of like a dour religion, because of how often it talks about, you know, not clinging and overcoming the obstacles we have. But I think it's the opposite. It's like it really understands this tremendous potential of the heart to be free, to be loving, to be kind, to be open. And it wants us to be able to access it realistically. And in situations where it's often very challenging to do it. And so we want to understand how it's difficult for us, how we pull away from that, how we close down to it, how we lose it, how we get it. Just like we use the word in Buddhism, suffering is a kind of universal word for all the ways in which we get caught and it hurts. The universal word for the category word for all the ways that we get covered over, our good heart gets covered over, is the word clinging. And clinging takes many, many different forms. It's not just like one thing, just a cling. But all the ways we get attached, that we get obsessive, we get compulsive, we get somehow caught, our buttons get pushed. You know, there's all kinds of ways of maybe saying the same thing. And one of the, I think, nutshell kind of explanations of Buddhism, the heart of it, is a little saying that if you cling, you will suffer. And if you let go of that clinging, that suffering will go away. The first half, if you cling, you will suffer. Well, you know, maybe some of you will recognize it. Oh, yeah, that's right. There are times where I cling and it hurts. It's difficult. It makes my life harder. And it's a drag. Oh, well, that's the way it is. Thank you for telling me. The second half is the good news. If you let go of that clinging, then that suffering will also go away or fade away. And that's the good news. It's possible to become free. And some people are not very satisfied with the religious goal that just the end of suffering, the end of clinging, because it's not, your neighbors down the street, they have much grander spiritual goals. They commune with the absolute. You know, they have oneness with God. They it's all kinds of great things, the way they talk about it. And they say, how about you? What are you up into? What are you up to? I'm into the, not clinging. And they kind of, oh, okay, well, it doesn't seem like it's so grand. But in fact, I think it's one of the grandest things. The consequences of not clinging, because the clinging is so pervasive in the heart, so deep rooted, that to really do the deep work to free yourself of that provides some of the most sublime and wonderful states of mind and states of heart possible. And more importantly, it clearly gives freedom to the heart, to some of the best qualities of heart have then have a chance to come surface and to be there. So clinging. So part of the task of Buddhists is to understand clinging, to understand how we cling, what we cling to. So part of Buddhist teachings is to understand the ecology of the mind, the human mind, and what goes on in there. And so there's a list of four species of clinging that sometimes they're considered visitors, so we can call them invasive species, because they don't really, part of the native territory at the heart. But and so sometimes when you introduce kind of invasive species, it kind of messes things up in the ecology. So these four invasive species are clinging to sensual pleasure, to comfort, clinging to views, opinions, to stories, clinging to self, self-identity, self-definition, and then clinging to what's usually translated as rites and rituals. And we can understand maybe as clinging to all kinds of religious practices. So the first one, clinging to sensual pleasure. Sometimes when it's presented that way, it's people will hear it and say, oh, that means like people who are, have a big problem with maybe alcohol or sex or these are people who are addicts or kind of all those extreme people. It doesn't relate to me. But in fact, most human life, and actually in Buddhism, human life is kind of defined as a life connected to a sensual pleasure, to pleasure or to comfort. And if you study yourself, honestly, through the day, through the week, how many decisions you make that are based on your comfort and your pleasure and avoiding unpleasantness and discomfort, you'll probably find that it's pervasive. Like you're making choices all the time. And some of them, many of them probably are innocent, and no one's saying you shouldn't do that. But it can be surprising how much it drives a person's life. The food you buy to eat, the way you cook, what you do, how much time do you spend, how much money do you spend, how much efforts do you make to do something which is more than what you basically need for your sustenance, but you do it because you want more pleasure. You know, some of you have cars, and there's a certain degree of pleasure and comfort in having a nice car, whatever that is. And I suspect most of you could downsize your cars, most of you, and if you have a car, and get along just really well, getting to where as transportation, and it's a car that costs less. Get a nice little used car, sell your car, and give your extra money to charity. The world could use it. But there's a certain degree of pleasure and comfort and delight and status and all kinds of things that come along with the car. And so we make choices, you know, and then people calculate, well, I deserve it. I remember the first time I ever went to a car dealership to test drive a car, and I think it was a little Honda Civic, and the dealer who was, you know, gave me a test drive as we were driving around. He started talking to me about getting an air conditioner for the car. And he said to me, "You deserve an air conditioner. You deserve it. It wasn't like it's practical, you'll feel comfortable, you'll get older someday, and, you know, and temperature is more, you're more sensitive to it. You know, it's not, no, you deserve it." So there's the justification for pleasure. So if you look, and it's not supposed to be a bad news that you look and, you know, make an inventory of all the choices you make that have to do with pleasure and comfort. It's not a criticism, but I think it's very interesting to become aware of it. Because once you become aware of it, then you can kind of assess, is there then in some of it, 10% of it, 2% of it, 99% of it, clinging, craving, you know, how much freedom do you have in those decisions? Are you caught in the grip of it and you feel kind of it's challenging that you're not to have it, you have to have it? And so to understand why, what's the beliefs, what's the emotions, what's going on for you? How much are you driven by the desire for pleasure, for comfort? And driven is a powerful word, because driven means that you have no choice, it's kind of acting on compulsion. And what Buddhism is looking for is an undriven life, an uncompulsive life, and a life that has no obsession to it, where we certainly engage in the world, but we're not being driven, we're driving. You know, we're for the freedom to choose and to follow our way. So to look at sensual pleasure, and if you look beyond your life, perhaps, you can see that there's a tremendous amount of harm that gets done in our world by people who are pursuing sensual pleasure, and, you know, pleasure, comfort, and all kinds, both for themselves, like people who have issues with addiction, but also the excessive consumption of things out of pleasure that requires tremendous amount of environmental damage to acquire those things, to make those things, to transport those things. And some of the things we can go so casually and innocently go down to a local market or store or to buy are creating economic havoc for people in some parts of the world where people have, you know, horrible conditions and where their life is getting worse and worse rather than better as we go and buy a simple thing. So that's one clinging, the clinging to sensual pleasure. The second clinging is to opinions. The classic word is views, but opinions, stories, philosophies, opinions. But I like the word stories because, many people don't want to admit they have views, you know, philosophical views. But a lot of people have stories that they're holding on to. Stories about who said what to who, stories, perspectives about different people, perspectives, stories about themselves, what happened to them, what they want to see happen, what it's all about. And we live in a world of story making, of beliefs, of views, of ideas of what is and isn't and what should be. And very few people, I think, recognize how attached they are to their own views and stories. So sometimes if you spend a little bit of time studying other people, it's often a lot easier to see, boy, they're really stuck in their views. You know, can't believe it. And, you know, and sometimes it's views about themselves. Like people are like, you want to shake them, you know, and say, no, you're not such a terrible person. People have sometimes a very negative feeling about themselves and feel that they don't want to really admit to other people what's really going on because they feel like they're already wrong and somehow bad and unworthy. And it's a story, it's an idea that they have. And some of these ideas are very, very deeply ingrained or, you know, in our system. Sometimes they come from our society. Messages from society that you're such a person and you're that kind of person and you're unworthy or not wanted or you're somehow special and you're wonderful. The epidemic, I think more around here probably than maybe other places in the world, but the whole movement to raise children who had high self-esteem. And so they got all this positive reinforcement. At least people now, psychologists now are writing that it was a disaster. And they kind of grew up and expected that everything's going to be given to them. They deserve it. And so now people are thinking, well, you know, maybe we should not raise kids with high self-esteem. And that's kind of the Buddhist point of view, you know, is you don't raise people with high self-esteem as much. Equally, you don't raise people with low self-esteem. You don't raise them with any self. not any self, but any kind of, you know, philosophy and ideas about who they are and who they are in comparison to others. But rather you help people to live an engaged, full, kind, peaceful, maybe passionate life, engaged life. But you don't need to kind of put this kind of veneer of either self-worth or lack of self-worth. Maybe Buddhists end up looking like they have self-esteem, self-worth, because they're engaged, but they don't think of themselves that way. They just are here, responding, dealing, doing what has to happen. So the stories, what stories do you live under as you go through the week to look at what are the beliefs, what are the things that you are believing are true in this situation, true about yourself, true about others, and then some of those things probably are true. But how do you relate to those truths? How do you relate to those stories? How do you relate to the memories? And as I'm fond of saying, every once in a while I have a grudge against someone, and I have learned that my grudges are usually not reliable. That there's a story, an idea that I'm holding on to that, somehow my little mind, I've kind of got a little wrapped around. And so what I've learned that because I make a habit often when I have a grudge, is to go find the person and be in their presence and talk to them. And as soon as I'm in their presence, the story that I've been living under doesn't have much power anymore, much legs. It's kind of like, you know, I can't sustain it. Some of these stories are most sustainable in the privacy of my own mind. And so it's important for me to get out of my mind. And one way to get out of these, you know, the stories of my mind is to be with the person I'm having challenge with and see them and see, you know, and then I have a different, because in my mind, I see the person only through the snapshot I have of them. When I'm with a person directly, they become, it's not just a snapshot, they become more dimensional. And so then it's, you know, it's usually, then I kind of, things soften up and my heart softens and then, you know, we have a conversation. So being caught by stories. So the third form of clinging is, I think of it as a variation of this views and stories and opinions, and that is self, clinging to self. And I've already talked a little bit about some of these things just now, but it's a seemingly very innocent thing to locate oneself here. I'm here, and you're there. And since I'm here, we can kind of start dressing here with stories and views and of all kinds. And we can also kind of start feeling very defensive or about the self. I'm here. And so it can seem very innocent to have this sense of I. But the I, when we have me, myself, and me, and not mine, we have I, it's a magnet for stories. It's a magnet for beliefs. And the more beliefs and stories we have around the I, the more we tend to cling around the I. And there can be a tremendous amount of clinging around I. And one of the places to see it, many places to see it, but one place to see it is when there's fear. Next time you feel anxious, look and see what is the nature of the I that's anxious. What's the beliefs around self that are operating when you're afraid? Chances are that most people in our kind of environment here, when you're afraid and anxious, it's not because the mountain lions are about to pounce. It's not because, you know, you're in a war zone and people are shooting, and it makes sense to be afraid. But often it's anxiety about imaginary things in the future, what might happen. And so it's a story, this imagination of the future. And so what is it, what's the sense of I that's going on? What's operating there? What's the beliefs, the stories we tell ourselves? It's hard to see. But that doesn't mean it's not useful to try to uncover what it is. And sometimes you're having a conversation with a friend and saying, you know, I'm anxious and I'm wondering, what is the notion of self that I'm operating under? I wonder if we can have a conversation. You can ask questions. We can explore what's going on here. You know, that I have an idea that, you know, to be a good self and a successful self, I have to show this side of me, or I can't have this happen, or, you know, I'm afraid of being rejected. That was a big thing when I was young, in my early 20s, is that I had a tremendous fear of being rejected by people. And so there was a story about self that I was unworthy and I would do something wrong and I'd be excommunicated from the Church of Human Beings. And so there's a lot of selfing going on there, a lot of self-ideation. This whole way we identify ourselves, define ourselves, it can be a place people cling. And one of the very important kind of directions that Buddhist practice goes is learning not to cling to self-definition, not clinging to self-identity, not clinging to me, myself, and mine. And not so you become invisible or you don't count or become, because you're not supposed to be anybody, you're supposed to be like a couch potato or I don't know what. But because we actually limit ourselves by the clinging to self-definition. And there's something about freeing ourselves from self-definition, the clinging to it, that actually makes us much bigger. It enhances us, makes us much more available to the world in a much more creative, dynamic way than if we have to be always just one way. And then the final clinging is clinging to In the Victorian English translations of Buddhist texts, it was called rites and rituals. And I think the Victorian English who made these translations, they were kind of reacting against Christianity and Catholicism and priesthood and rites and rituals and superstition. So the two words. It's sila and vata. And sila in Pali means ethics or precepts. And vata, it can mean a variety of things, but it also just means religious practices. I like to interpret these two words, sila, vata, in the most broad way possible. It's being attached to ethics and spiritual practices of every kind. So for those of you who are kind of troubled by having ethics and precepts, you know, and you know, are happy to hear this. the aversion and resistance and reaction against ethics and precepts is a kind of clinging. So, you know, don't be too much into being against them. But religious people all over, and I've seen it in Buddhism plenty of times, they tend to cling sooner or later to their practices and to their ethics and their behavior. And it makes some sense because you're doing something you think is very helpful and valuable, something you love, and so you kind of want to preserve it or be into it. It's very important for you, doing it for very important reasons. It's like your lifeline, the practices, and so you want to hold on to that lifeline because it's so important. But often the clinging which is really dangerous is the clinging where the religious practices and ethics are entangled with clinging to self. So the third clinging. Self-identity, trying to prove oneself and show oneself as being someone special. And I saw this when I first was involved in Zen. There was this, independent of the Zen kind of robes and stuff that people wore at times at the Zen Center, when they walked around kind of in life, just in general, a lot of people had a uniform. This was back in the 1970s. And the uniform was kind of like, I think it was an Amish vest, a Danish school bag, a mala, beads around your wrist, fat pants, they were called back then. They were kind of these very broad, wide kind of pants that you could meditate in easily, and Birkenstocks. And I think that the first person who wore, you know, found the particular items and wore it, it made sense. You know, it's kind of, they're practical and nice, maybe in a nice way. But, you know, after a while it became like the uniform of people. All these people were wearing these same kind of things. And I looked, what's going on? And I think it had to do with a certain kind of identity, a certain kind of, attachment to what this, ethics, mores, behavior, attachments to the practice, to the religion, and wanting to show, look who I am. I'm one of the in crowd because I wear Amish vests that have a Zen kind of flavor to it. So even though ethics is a very important part of Buddhist practice, even though religious practices are a very important part of it, there can be a lot of clinging to it. Clinging to meditation, clinging to our books and our Dharma talks and wanting comfort and wanting this and wanting it just right. And part of all that is clinging to spiritual experiences, meditation experiences. If I just do my meditation practice, then I'll get, I have to have this experience. It's an experience which will define me, and then I'll be okay if I have that experience. And it becomes a chase after, more self. And it was wonderful for me to be in my Zen training, because it was always unexpected when they would ask you to stop meditating, to do something else. And you could be sitting meditating in the early morning, meditating, and someone would come and tap you on the finger, on the shoulder, and say, we need you in the kitchen. Now. And, I'm just getting concentrated. I was just on the brink of enlightenment, this is where, sitting is where it's at. Kitchen, some toilet was, toilet was flowing and leaking, and we have to fix it now. But there's more important things than fixing the toilet. My meditation. I'm going to lose it. I'll never get back to it, whatever. And so this, the Zen training had a fantastic way of helping you understand how you were clinging to your practices and your religion and all that. And it was really marvelous, for me at least, to get to see that clinging and then discover something that this is the secret of this whole emphasis on clinging, is that it actually feels better to let go of clinging than it is to get what you want. there's something very profound and significant about the release that happens. So if I'm if I cling to something, it's kind of like having a tight fist, you know, gripping onto something. And, you know, I might still be able to do what I want to accomplish or get what I want to do while I have the hand in a tight grip. But it feels so good to release the grip and be free. And that's part of the wonderful secret of Buddhist practice, is how wonderful it is to be free. How wonderful it is to let go of the grip, let go of the clinging. We let go into freedom. We let go into ease and peace and openness. And to begin to value and appreciate and be delighted, to feel attracted to the pleasure, the meaningfulness, the openness, the satisfaction, the peace of a heart and a mind that doesn't cling to anything, is kind of the, you know, the direction we're going. And what's marvelous about this non-clinging is that as soon as you cling to even that, you've lost it. So you can't quite have it in the conventional way of having something. You're used to having something by holding on to it and defining yourself by it and being it and, you know, making a great story about it. You have to kind of keep opening and keep opening. And you kind of, in a wonderful way, you're kind of left with nothing. Because as soon as you make it into something, you begin tightening up. And in that not having nothing, which is an ancient Buddhist idea, the idea of having nothing, not because you have physically nothing, but you're not clinging to anything. And then what can flow is the best qualities of our hearts and be available to ourselves, be available to the world. And I think that this is where our kindness has a chance to flow. And whatever kindness might mean for you, love, kindness, care, generosity, goodness. And then the notion of kindness and compassion and love can be a helpful reference point to help you understand when you start clinging again. Because when you lose the kindness, lose the compassion, lose the inner peace, that's a fantastic, wonderful, important place to stop and look and see what's going on. So, paraphrase another quote that I like. The bumper sticker for Buddhists is, I stop for clinging. So, as you go through this week, stop for clinging. Look at it. Get to know your clinging better. And see if you can discover what's on the other side of clinging. There's another side of it. So, thank you.